You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with the Writer, where readers
and writers meet,
and story
is
everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to Hot Texas with the Hot Texas Swing Band.
And we are delighted to have you joining us tonight. This is episode 187, if you go looking forward to replay it later. And we have a full house. Kicking off June 2026 is our good friend, Henry C. Park.
Howdy.
Hello, Henry. And our special guest, we're so excited to welcome Kirk Ellis. Hello,
Kirk.
Hello. So let's see, Henry, where are you joining us from tonight?
Today, I'm joining you from beautiful Van Nuys.
All right.
Beautiful so as it gets.
West Coast. You're on the West Coast.
That's right.
And Kirk, where are you tonight?
Santa Fe, New Mexico. Although I lived once in L.A. not too far from Henry in Sherman Oaks. So,
I
prefer the Southwest.
And so we're like an hour away from Kirk in Albuquerque. And here, you know, he is in Santa Fe. It feels like we're just neighbors.
Almost.
So let's see. Jim, where are we tonight?
Well, I'll tell you. We're in the back seat of this hot wire 1933 Ford convertible driving down this dusty road called Highway 154 at 80 miles an hour. Bonnie and Clyde are in the front seat hooting and hollering. Can robbing banks be this much fun? Wait, we're slowing down as Clyde sees a motorist in distress on the right side of the road. As they look to the left, I see some movement behind some tall bushes. Bobby, I got a bad feeling about this.
Jim, you put us in the most compromising situations. Well, Henry, while we figure out what to do while we're in that car, why don't you give us your monthly report, Henry's Western Roundup. Take it away.
Thank you. Well, now here's some exciting news. There's a new Western in production, Blood on the Promontory, and it's about five escaped convicts who are shackled together trying to escape over mountains following a bloody train robbery. It stars Sam Worthington from the Avatar films and chapters one and two of Kevin Costner's New Horizon, no new, sorry. Jay Courtney, who is in American Primeval and Taylor Sheridan's Dutton Ranch. Jack Quaid from the Hunger Games franchise and the Boys franchise, who I liked a lot in last year's Novocaine. LaMonica Garrett, who was terrific as Sam Elliott's wingman in the superb 1883. And Tokala Black Elk from American Primeval, 1883. Wind River, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and something written by our guest Kirk Ellis, 2005's Into the West.
The West, yep.
Let's see, the director, Raymond Doza, is a former Navy SEAL who was deployed to Iraq and has been a stuntman and technical advisor on numerous action films. And then last year, he co-wrote and co-directed Warfare, a true Iraq war story, which I missed, but which made a great impression on viewers and the industry. The script is by Evan Cooper, who's worked in various capacities on 1883, 1923, and Lawman Bass Reeves, and makes his feature screenplay debut with Blood on the Promontory. And seeing as 90% of the titles I just referenced were all Taylor Sheridan shows, it's worth noting that this week Netflix added Lawman Bass Reeves to its service. And it's Netflix's number five most popular show across the globe. David Oyelowo stars, and I understand it was a project he spent years putting together. Did anyone else watch it?
We saw some of it. Yeah, we've seen some of it.
I was mixed on it. It's definitely worth seeing. Oyelowo, Dennis Quaid, Barry Pepper are all very good, and I think Donald Sutherland's turn as Judge Parker is his final Western. But I think it suffered from Taylor Sheridan not actually scripting it, unlike almost everything else with his name on it.
Huh, that's interesting.
Oh, here's one to look forward to. S. Craig Zahlner, who wrote and directed Bone Tomahawk, has a new project in pre-production. It's called The Brigands of Rattle Creek, and it will be director Park Chan-wook's first English-language feature in over a decade. According to the one-liner, it, quote, follows a sheriff and a doctor who seek revenge against a group of bandits who use the cover of a torrential thunderstorm to rob and terrorize the occupants of a small town. And it will star Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club, and star of Free State of Jones and Lone Star, Austin Butler, who was Oscar nominated for Elvis, and played Tex Watson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, kind of a Western, Pedro Pascal, who stars in everything, including The Mandalorian, which many consider a Western, and Tang Wei, a Chinese actress who will be doing her first Western, not surprisingly. Happy 100th birthday to Marilyn Monroe, who starred with Robert Mitchum and Rory Calhoun in The River of No Return, and with Clark Gable and Montgomery Clift for John Huston in The Misfits. That would be the last movie for Monroe, for Gable, and for one-time Western star Rex Bell, whose widow, incidentally, was one of the greatest stars of the silent screen. That's right. I just found out the last cut in Taylor Swift's Tortured Poets Department is called Clara Bow, and it's kind of about her.
That's right. I remember that now. Yeah.
Now, please check out the May, June True West with my tribute to Robert Duvall and Gus McRae. And you can read about all this and so much more at henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
And Henry, since we're talking about this issue,
yes,
we're just going to flip to Stuart Rosebrook's review.
Oh,
I can get it in the camera, right? There we go.
That's the first time I've seen it in print. I knew Stuart had written it, and I got the text, but I never saw the magazine until now.
Let me see if I can give you a better. Hold on, Kirk. Let's see if I can give
you. We should have got you one, Kirk.
If I can get you a better.
That looks good. I like it.
Yeah.
Slow fade to infamy. That should be on my tombstone. So, yeah.
And it's a great review. That's right. I did. I texted it to you. That's right. Yeah,
that's right. You did do that. Let's see if I can find a copy. Okay?
We'll see if we can get one in the mail to you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, we are so delighted to have you both with us. And of course, Henry, we just heard exciting news about your daughter and an Emmy.
Oh, yes.
You want to do a little shout out to Sabrina?
Absolutely. Yes. My daughter, Sabrina, and her team just won a Emmy for Turning Point, the Vietnam War, which is a 5-part documentary series on Netflix. And they won the Best Researched Emmy.
So exciting.
That's great.
You know, Kirk, you've won 2 Emmys. What was it like to hear your name called, even nominated and then called? What was that like for you?
My first Emmy was for John Adams. I won 2 Emmys that night, one as a writer and one as a producer. And the first one, I had totally clammy Undertaker hands. It was just incredible. And that was, I think it was the first year they moved it to, I'm trying to remember what the venue, I think it may have been the Kodak Theater at Highland in Hollywood. And you don't really understand what it is until you're up on stage and you turn around and there's 5,000 people there. And there's a big monitor. And by the time I got up there, the monitor was already saying, wrap it up.
Oh.
So it's hardly glamorous, but I'll never forget that the two who presented me with the award were Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart.
Oh, Oh my gosh.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I was notoriously cut off in my acceptance speech. They literally turned the mic off on me. I was told later it was because they were doing what was called a hard commercial break, and they couldn't go over like the 8 o'clock hour. But I think everybody in the theater thought it was for political reasons.
Oh my goodness.
I was able to get out. I said, I wanted to thank David McCullough and HBO and, all my colleagues, for giving me the opportunity to write about a time when people in government, spoke complex thoughts in complete sentences. And then the mic went dead.
Oh my goodness.
I think you just offended people who don't speak in complete sentences.
Sentences. Oh my goodness. Well, congratulations on that.
Congratulations.
Out of curiosity, we're very interested in John Adams. It's a long story I won't go into, but what inspired you to research him and to put that together?
Well, most of the work you get as a screenwriter is actually assignment-based.
Okay.
So that was a project that came to me from Tom Hanks' company, Playtone. We had worked together on a potential ongoing series about class at West Point, following them from plebe year all the way through graduation. But we couldn't get it off the ground. There was a debate over the budget between Tom's company and ABC. But we established a relationship, and we both share a tremendous interest in history and real stories. So when his company optioned the book, they called me up as the person to adapt it. That's how a lot of things happen.
If you
don't burn bridges and you're disciplined and you work on deadline, you work with the same people over and over again, and there's a shorthand to things.
Well, we are going to take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to really be getting into a very in-depth conversation about this remarkable book that Kirk Ellis was published earlier this year, They Kill People, Bonnie and Clyde, A Hollywood Revolution, and America's Obsession with Guns and Outlaws. And Henry, can I speak for you too when we say, what a book. We couldn't put it down, and you Absolutely. Must have this on your, don't even have it on your reading list. You need it now.
You need it on your lap.
Start reading it now. Exactly. We are going to take a short break, and we're just going to announce with our, and thank our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. They do so much for us. Are you a writer? Our sponsors, as I said, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, are standing by to assist you. And they have a special offer created with you in mind. Jim and I took advantage of it for our Rendezvous with a Writer launch page. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Kirk Ellis and Henry Park. You don't want to miss this. Don't go away. Authors, welcome home. Every author needs a website, a home base for their brand. Professionally showcase your books and brand with a custom website landing page starting at $369. Bluebookshelf.com. It's a great feeling to be home. Contact the Blue Cottage team today to get started.
Welcome back. You're running with the writer. We're talking to Henry Park and Kirk Ellis, and you just heard Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Lester Flack and Earl Scruggs, it's in the movie.
In the movie, Bonnie and Clyde.
It's actually written into the script.
Written into the script. And
How many times actually is it used in the movie? Because I noticed I was just rewatching it. Is it like three times or more?
Yeah, at least three times. And then the Charles Strauss music that was newly composed really sort of doubles it. You know, it's mm-hmm. quite seamless. So
yeah. So we are talking with Henry, and by the way, I didn't hand out Henry, yeah. also an author, and this is another really great book, Greatest Westerns Ever Made and the People Who Made Them, and we recommend that you get the book and then watch the movie as you are reading what Henry has to say about it. And Kirk, the book we're going to get into in just a moment, again, I'm going to hold it up to the camera, They Kill People, there we go.
Double whammy.
Kirk recommends early on that you may want to read the book. I mean, read the movie before you read the book or as you're reading the book. And that is really good advice, isn't it?
I've got to say, I read probably the first four or five chapters and I said, I have to stop and watch the movie again because I don't think I'd seen it beginning to end since 68.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, Jim, tell us a little bit about our special guest, Kirk Ellis.
Kirk Ellis won two Emmys, a WGA Award, a Peabody, and Humanitas Prize for his work as a writer and co-executive producer on the HBO miniseries John Adams. The miniseries won 13 Emmys in total, as well as four Golden Globes. That's super. Since 2019... Kurt has written or co-written the National Memorial Day Concert for PBS. I must say, one we just watched was superb.
We love it. We never miss it.
And received a Writers Guild nomination for his work on the 2022 show. His first nonfiction book, Ride Lonesome, was published in spring of 2023. Tonight, we're looking at his second book, They Kill People, Bonnie and Clyde, A Hollywood Revolution and America's Obsession with Guns and Outlaws.
You can see, Kirk, we left in all
of our... Let me press my post-it notes, believe me. Yeah.
We really think there should be one for every page because, I don't know, Henry, I felt like every page had something I wanted not to forget. Did you feel that way too?
Oh, yes. I've got to say, I was taking a lot of notes while I was reading because I thought there were things that I wanted to ask Kirk about afterwards. You know, one of them, I found it fascinating to read that Clyde Barrow carried a copy of William Noble Burns' biography of Billy the Kid.
Right.
You know what that reminded me of? Was that ever since Mark David Chapman murdered John Lennon, several assassins, when caught, were carrying copies of The Catcher in the Rye because Chapman had one with him when he shot Lennon. And it's just... It's so strange the way psychos copy each other.
Well, they actually found a copy of the Walter Noble Burns book in the backseat of the death car after they were assassinated in Louisiana. And it shows that Clyde certainly saw himself as an extension of these old Western outlaws. You know, instead of riding a horse, he was riding a stolen V8 at faster speeds. So...
Yeah, and there was a saxophone in there too, that final car, I think.
Yeah, he played the saxophone.
Yeah, I thought that was so interesting because as we see in the movie, they're constantly needing to, you know, replace the car that they had taken. And then when you see how much they sort of, the arsenal of weapons and such, and I think, okay, so when they would stop and like, okay, we need another car, how many, you know, back and forth did it take to get everything out of them?
Right, and back in again, right. And sometimes they didn't have that option. They had to abandon the car and take another one with all the stuff left behind.
You know, I don't think there's anybody in the world who could hot wire a car as fast as that guy could.
Right. It's funny, he had a reputation, Clyde Barrow had a reputation for these superhuman drives that he would take. He would go 1,000 miles in a night across four or five state lines. Because the laws at that point, police couldn't pursue criminals across state lines.
Right, that's right.
They do that.
Yeah.
So in retracing some of those journeys, it's inconceivable now with highways and interstates to do those kinds of drives. But in the 30s, when, you know, you didn't have macadam roads, a lot of these were dirt roads, paths and things. It's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the book here. Yeah. I think it's, you told us the other night, it's a 3-year project, you know, and it's, you really get into America and the gun and how our country developed. And I, after a while, I just saw it as manifest destiny and guns. Right. Why don't you, you know, give us your take on this, Kurt?
Well, it was surprising for me to find out that even though Bunny and Clyde had been a major component of certain other film books, particularly Five Pictures of a Revolution by Mark Harris, which chronicles the production histories of the films that were all nominated for the 1968 Oscar. But there had never been a book about Bonnie and Clyde itself. And because I come from a film background, I, you know, felt I was in a good position to look at the production of the film from an insider's point of view and really get to how it was put together, how it was shot, how it was post-produced, and all those other things. But because I've spent most of my life as a historical dramatist, I certainly know a lot about how history gets kind of transformed into drama. You know, history becomes legend, legend becomes myth. And that is certainly the outlaw history of America, whether you're talking about Jesse James or Billy the Kid or Bonnie and Clyde. So it was a chance to look at the film and do a thorough job of really, you know, explaining how the film came to be, but also to use it as a launching pad to talk about some of the darker aspects of American history and American culture, this singular fixation we have on the renegade individual. And Bonnie and Clyde were only unique in that they were a couple. That's what gave them their popularity in the 30s. They were a man and a woman. But they were part of that whole chain of people who, for whatever reason, feel they've been wronged. They can't catch a break. They're gonna take it to the man, take it to the establishment by any means necessary. So that's been part of our history from the Revolution onward. What makes our history unique is that, unlike any other frontier societies like Australia or Canada, ours is really bound up with firearms. The rifle that went from a utilitarian tool into a status symbol, into a sort of political symbol. So that's what I really wanted to get at with the book. And that's why, as you know from having read it, it works on three different planes at once. There's the plane of the film and how it was made. There's the plane of the Barrow Gang, who they were in real life, and how that life differed from the film, what the film chose to show, and what it didn't. And then the larger issues that the film and the outlaw tradition bring up to us in the present day.
Yeah.
You know, I thought you did a great job of tying those all three together. And I thought it was amazing that you could talk about Bonnie and Clyde, but then talk about the movie, and then talk about Bonnie and Clyde, and then talk about the history of the country.
The NRA and the this and that. And I felt like I was getting a great primer on our, you know, 1930s, 33 specifically, kind of, you know, 33 to 34, about what's sort of going on. And that's, you know, that story, because it's even bigger than who Bonnie and Clyde are. It's
it's
what's happening in banks were closing, you know, banks were closing, and those kinds of things. And then we jump right away. We're like, oh, and here we are in the 60s when the film's being made, and here we are, you know, and we're back again, and now we're at the Revolutionary War.
Well, you don't write about a film at random. You want to find a film that has lasting value. And Arthur Penn, the director of the film, said that he wanted to make a movie that had 1 foot in the 60s and 1 foot in the 30s, because the similarities in those eras were quite remarkable. But in doing that, he also made a film that speaks to us now. The film will be 60 years old next year, speaks to us across, you know, more than half a century, because America is still in the same place that it was then.
Yeah.
History isn't something I learned in being a historical dramatist. History doesn't move in a straight line. It moves in a circle. It never quite reconnects itself. And that's what Penn and the writers Robert Benton and David Newman saw in the story. In fact, in a letter that Benton and Newman wrote to their original choice for director, François Truffaut, because they were influenced by the French New Wave, and it's one of those wonderful imponderables to think about what a film Truffaut might have made of that script, but. They said that, you know, Bonnie and Clyde aren't then. Bonnie and Clyde are now, and their world is happening now. So they saw these contemporary parallels in the historical story.
Wow. Henry, I'm sure you have a comment you'd love to, or a question you'd love to share.
Yes. Well, I love the book. I'm a big fan of the genre of the making of kind of books. But one thing that I particularly like about this is, I mean, what you're doing is like reverse engineering a movie along with telling the history. Mm. And it takes detective work. And there are, you know, there's some very good making of books, and there are some that, you know, they're trying real hard, but they're not written by people who understand the film process. And as you have been, you know, a screenwriter and been in a million meetings, pitch meetings and so on, I get the sense that you have a much better understanding of the actual filmmaking process and working up to the filmmaking process than most writers. So without being too modest, you know, could you react to that?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, Henry, thank you for saying that. That was certainly something I felt I had an advantage in doing the book. So the Bonnie and Clyde is the last movie for which there are any records in the Warner Brothers files at the University of Southern California. And working on this book, the research and writing took a little over 3 years. And for a chunk of that, I couldn't get to those files because the Cinematic Arts Library, USC, was closed for the pandemic and in the immediate aftermath. So I was working on other sections of the book, but for the actual physical production, when you know, its whole history from shooting in Texas and then the Warner Brothers lot from roughly October to January, 67 to 68. So when I finally got in there are one box. The Warner Brothers file, the Bonnie and Clyde files in the Warner Brothers archives are one box. And you go in, you can't do no photocopying. You can't. They provide you with note 3x5, 4x6 note cards, and pencils to write everything down. So I had a day to go through this entire file, which included Warren Beatty's personal copy of the script, Jack Warner's personal copy of the script. I love research. Included all of the call sheets for every day of production. So I was able to figure out, you know, what was shot when and how certain things just happened on the set because there wouldn't have been time to actually do a rewrite of the script. Although they had Robert Towne there theoretically doing, you know, the on-set rewrites. But it was a great way to look at how Bonnie and Clyde had come together physically. And then going to Texas to these locations where the film was shot, many of which were also places that Bonnie and Clyde haunted in their escapades, was also a revelation because just as Penn and his crew found that none of those towns had changed from the Depression to the 1960s, I found them completely unchanged from 1966 to when I went there in must have been 2021. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's I want to jump ahead. I want to jump just to another topic that was so very interesting. We didn't really know about the codes that, what can be filmed, production codes. We learned a little bit with Mark Archuleta when he was here just a month ago with his book on Henry Starr. But we thought that maybe if you would take a moment, because there are some things that happened in this film that the codes were kind of, at odds with, or if you would like to maybe take a scene or two and kind of tell us about how the codes related to those.
Yeah, so the production code actually dates back to the silent era, but it was never really enforced. And in the early days of talkies, which coincided with the onset of the Great Depression, sex and violence became common currency in studio filmmaking from 1929 to 1934. And ultimately, it ran afoul of the High Sheriffs and the Legion of Decency, the Catholic Legion of Decency. And the code was exactly that. It prescribed a code of conduct for what could or could not be shown. It was both a physical and a visual code, but also a moral code. The best description I've ever read of it said it was a Jewish-owned business selling Catholic ideology to a Protestant audience in America. So
remember that.
but specific to Bonnie and Clyde, there were rules about how you could show a gunplay in films, and the rule was you could never fire a gun in one shot and land the bullet in the same shot. There always had to be a cut in between. But Bonnie and Clyde, everybody knows it from the sort of the final massacre. Spoiler alert, by the way. But the key sequence for its impact on Hollywood filmmaking is about halfway through. Bonnie and Clyde, they perform a pretty seamlessly executed bank robbery, but they're newly minted wheelman, C.W. Moss, decides in the midst of the heist to parallel park the car. And then he can't get it out. And that creates enough time for a bank official to jump on the running board as they're leaving town. And Clyde sort of impulsively pulls his gun and fires through the window in the same shot. And you see the bullet go through the window and the guy's head explodes behind it. And that was written into the script by David Newman and Robert Benton. It's very specific. The bank official's head explodes in blood. He drops from sight. next to that stage direction, Jack Warner's copy of the script is written, "No," in really big letters, circled and underlined. But they got away with it. And
quite a scene.
It wasn't just violence that Bonnie and Clyde took risk with. There was also still kind of shocking sex, but particularly for 1967, when we meet Bonnie, she's completely naked. It's cleverly disguised, and there are always obstructions in the frame, but she's naked. When she stands at the window and says, "Hey, boy, what are you doing with my mama's car?" So there were many instances. My favorite of those is because it was a real slap in the face to the code. Their first attempt at lovemaking is on a bed full of guns.
Yeah, that's right.
Just sort of sweep the bed away of these, Tommy guns and automatic rifles and everything. So they knew exactly what they were doing with this. And as I see in the book, this, led very directly to what Peckinpah did in The Wild Bunch. He was about to start shooting it down in Pras, Mexico, and he got Warner Brothers to send him a copy of the print of Bonnie and Clyde. And he said, "Well, if Arthur Penn did that at the end of Bonnie and Clyde, we've got to top it." And that's how you ended up with the Battle of Bloody Porch in The Wild Bunch. Yeah.
There's a comment that you make in the book, and it you introduce the National Firearms Act of 1934. Yeah. And if you would just take a moment and talk about that, and then we're going to take a short break. but I think we need to hear about that.
Sure. So one of the big revelations in the book, because you have preconceived notions of people and organizations, is that in 1934, the National Rifle Association actually supported a significant amount of gun control. Because what was happening is, whether it was the Barrow Gang or it was John Dillinger or Pretty Boy Floyd, the Barkers, you know, all the people that J. Edgar Hoover went after, it was giving legitimate gun owners a bad name. So the NRA came out in support of what became the Firearms Act of 1934, which is still on the books, and it's the reason that all automatic weapons are banned. Automatic weapon, of course, being a weapon where you pull the trigger, and as long as you have your finger on the trigger and pressure on it, it'll just keep firing, as opposed to semi-automatic where you've got to pull the trigger each time. So what was shocking to me is looking at the testimony that Carl Frederick, who was head of the National Rifle Association at the time, gave before Congress when he was asked if there were any Second Amendment objections to a firearms ban. And this is the head of the NRA, and he says, "I don't see how the Second Amendment really plays into this." Mm-hmm. That's not testimony you would hear today.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
You have to read the book. You have to watch the movie and have to read the book. We're going to step away for just a moment to tell you about one of the places that you can order the books of many of our guests, including Kirk Ellis's book and Henry's book. And that is our affiliate page at bookshop.org. And when we come back, more with Kirk and Henry. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Bonnie was a waitress in a small cafe. Clyde Barrow was the rounder that took her away. They both robbed and killed until both of them died. So goes the legend of Bonnie and Clyde. The poem that she wrote of the life that they led, told of the lawmen left dying or dead. Some say that Clyde made her life a shame, but the legend made Bonnie the head of the game. The rampage grew wilder with each passing day, the odds growing smaller with each getaway. With the end growing closer, the harder they fought. With blood on their hands, they were bound to get caught.
Just been listening to The Legend of Bonnie and Clyde by that great performer Merle Haggard.
Such you a know, great song.
You have a lot of quotes, and you have a lot. You start each chapter with a quote.
Yeah.
How did you decide to do that, and how long did it take to find all those great quotes?
You a quote collector?
Well, no, the quotes grew organically out of the material. You're looking for those epigraphs, you know, to sort of kick off your argument every time you shift gears. But it's actually harder to come up with the titles for the chapters themselves. That takes some work. But yeah, no, that's you. Over the course of research, you come up with a lot of pithy sayings that really just are a grace note for the argument.
You even quote Oscar Wilde and Dickens, yes. And you know,
that's the most apropos quote in the book. Oscar Wilde said that Americans love their heroes, and they always take their heroes from the criminal class.
It's in our DNA, isn't it, Kirk?
Yes. There's something wrong with that, isn't it?
Well, I make it a real point to be scrupulously non-judgmental about all of this, because you don't want to alienate one half of your audience by writing a polemic. I'm simply presenting this history of firearms and violence in American society in the context of Bonnie and Clyde, and letting readers draw their own conclusions. Whether they agree with what they think is my conclusion or whether they disagree with it, that's not important. There's that process by which you're confronting some things you might not have thought about before.
Yeah. Henry. Oh, I was just going to say.
Oh, yeah. Henry, do you ever?
Must have something to say.
Do you have a question?
Always. You know, I was thinking about the character Frank Hamer, who, of course, is a real man that Denver Pyle played. And like so many characters, like C.W. Moss is W.D. Jones and several other people compressed. Right. And what Frank Hamer is shown doing, it is certainly correct that he was there to kill them at the end. But his earlier involvement, I think, was compressed from other characters and just invented. And how did that go over with the Hamer family?
You know, in the original script, his name is Frank Bryce. Mm-hmm. It's lost to history exactly how either Ben and Newman or Arthur Penn in the course of production decided to make him Frank Hamer. But it was seen as a problem at the time. Warner Brothers' legal department anticipated there would be a lawsuit, and there was. Hamer was no longer around, but his heirs were. And there was an out-of-court settlement for that. And, you know, for many, many years, the portrayal of Frank Hamer was one of the things that really got people's goat about the movie, particularly if they were on the side of Law and Order, right? So eventually, a movie was made by John Lee Hancock called The Highwayman with Kevin Costner and Woody Harrelson to try to set the record straight. It didn't do a better job than Bonnie and Clyde did. The portrait of Hamer in that was 180 degrees in the opposite direction in terms of who he was. And when you read about Frank Hamer and you read about the Texas Rangers, and the history of Texas Rangers is pretty sordid, frankly.
Yeah.
And Hamer was as much of a thug as the people he was trying to bring to justice, in fact. And, you know, Arthur Penn, in one of his interviews, post-screenings of the film in 67, was saying, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to say, you know, who was the bigger criminal, Bonnie and Clyde or Frank Hamer. I think I'd probably have to go with Frank Hamer.
Frank Hamer, yeah.
So, and these are, you know, this again gets to that whole 30s-60s thing. In the 30s, people didn't like banks. They didn't like, and they didn't like the police, because the police were often in league with the banks, throwing people out of their foreclosed banks.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that was happening in the 60s as well. With you know, the what was roiling America, you know, and was leading to the riots, was a very similar feeling of this helplessness and disenfranchisement, and we're still seeing that today. So it's, I mean, when people, you know, when, and a lot of cops get killed in the movie in Bonnie and Clyde, and when the film was shown, particularly near city audiences, 67, people applauded, people cheered, you know, that was the nature of the time then. It took Ben and Newman many years to get the film off the ground, and I think one of the reasons they were able to finally get it off the ground with Arthur Penn was that America changed.
America changed.
Remember, this film goes into production in Texas, okay, in 1966, okay, in the shadow of what was then the worst mass shooting in American history, when Charles Whitman went to the top of the tower at the University of Austin, and in the course of 90 minutes killed almost two dozen people. So that was in the zeitgeist, and Penn, I think, really knew that that was going to be an essential part of the film. And by being as realistic as he could be in showing the Depression, and there are shots in that movie that look like Dorothea Lange photographs.
Absolutely.
Exactly. All very deliberate. But it was also a callback to what was happening in America of the time of the production.
Gentlemen, I'm looking at the time. I can't believe how fast it's flowing.
Everybody will have to buy the book.
Absolutely.
Take a press 312 pages.
I was hoping we'd get to Gene Wilder and that really funny, that really funny scene, but you just have to watch the movie and get the book. Very quickly, Mr. Park, Henry, tell us, where can people find you, follow you, and get your book?
Well, people can get my book, of course, from you good folks on your page. And beyond that, you can find me every issue of True West. And I write Henry's Western Roundup, the online report on Western film production. And I also write a lot of columns for the INSP Channels blog. Other than that, you can find me in the gazebo in the backyard.
And next month, Henry, you'll be with us, of course, the first Thursday.
Right.
And we'll have Cindy Mitchum and Courtney will be with us, and we'll be talking about them ornery. I didn't bring the book to show to the camera. Them ornery brothers, the Mitchum brothers. I think I'm not saying that correct, but
them ornery Mitchum boys.
Yeah, the boys. Yes, and we'll be talking about film again in that hour. And Mr. Ellis, we really thank you, Kirk, for being with us. And where can people find you, follow you, and so what
I'm
you
on
got
Facebook.
Next?
I'm on Instagram, and I don't have a huge social media presence. I'm a bit of a Luddite as far as things go. I still write longhand. I miss my old electric typewriter, etc. But I'm all over Santa Fe. That's for sure.
Wonderful. Jim, you have a quote?
We have a quote. As I said before, there's a million great quotes in this book, but I think we need to hear from the poet herself, Bonnie Parker. You read the story of Jesse James, of how he lived and died. If you're still in need of something to read, here's the story of Bonnie and Clyde.
And you do need to read this. If we didn't say it often enough, we're going to say it again. You need to read it. Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. We want to thank you all for joining us, whether you're listening live tonight or you're catching this as a replay. This is episode 187, and you can find the video on Rendezvous with a Writer and LA Talk Radio's Facebook pages and YouTube on LA Talk Radio. And later tonight, I will be posting it on Podbean, where you'll be able to pick the audio up on your favorite platform. We want to say a thank you to LA Talk Radio's founder and engineer and our DJ tonight, Sam Hassan. Our sponsors, Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, and the Hot Texas Swing Band. Again, a special thank you to Henry and to Kirk giving us your time tonight. And next week, join us for another engaging rendezvous with our guests. Next week, we will be switching gears and we'll be getting into science fiction with multi-award-winning science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer. And we'll be talking about his brand new book. It's the second in the series, Downloaded 2, Ghosts in the Machine. I had the privilege of talking to Robert a few years ago on the Writer's Block radio show when his book Oppenheimer, The Alternative, came out. And I was awash with praise for that book. And so we're excited to catch up with Robert with his brand new book. Jim, do you have a closing comment?
Well, thank you again. And as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing.
We'll keep reading.
We'll see you down the trail. Bye, everybody. Bye. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you.